It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome back to Money for Lunch. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. Hey, I am glad you're here. We're just going to dive right into it. The quote of the day. The quote of the day was sent to me by Mark S. So if you want your quote on the air, send it to me. I'm available on all the social medias, and or at least most of them, and then you can reach out to me, Bert at BertMartinez.com. If we pick your quote, not only will we give you credit on the air, but we also will send you out some neat swag. So the quote of the day, the best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others, by the great Mahatma Gandhi. The best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. Mahatma Gandhi, one of my favorite quotes. I think this guy was, a prophet almost, for lack of a better term. Certainly, he embodied a lot of great spiritual traits and used willpower and passiveness, not passive. He wasn't passive. He was definitely patient and nonviolence, I think, was the thing that he was radically famous for, right? I mean, he would go on these extremely long hunger strikes, or at least fasting, and really got people to resolve their differences as peacefully as possible. So I have a lot of respect for Mahatma Gandhi. So Mark, thank you so very much for sending that out. All right, let's get this party started. On the show today, we have Devin Thorpe. Devin Thorpe is the author, educator, and speaker. He calls himself a champion of social good. He travels extensively as a volunteer doing service, as a journalist finding heroes, and as a speaker sharing what he's learned. As a Forbes contributor, he covers social entrepreneurship and impact investing, reaching an audience of over 2 million people. He's produced over 1,000 episodes of his Your Mark on the World show featuring luminary change agents. Devin Thorpe, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here, Bert. I really appreciate the invitation. You've got such a great show, great following. Thank you.
You're very welcome, and I really do appreciate you stopping by as well. I'm intrigued by this moniker, for lack of better terms, this idea of being a champion for social good. And I think that there is a lot of social good happening out there, but we don't really get to hear about it. And so I think it surprises people sometimes when I guess good things are happening and you have volunteers like yourself and other people that are making it happen. And I just think it shocks, the media just doesn't report all the social good that's happening and how people can get involved. So therefore, I think it sometimes wakes us up, shocks us a little bit. What do you think?
Well, I think you're right. People are much more drawn, sadly, to the tragic stories than to the ordinary solutions.
Yes.
And so I write about solutions. That's where I spend my time. And I find most of the stories don't get a lot of attention. I wish they got more attention, but there is something about reading about a train wreck, literal or figurative, that draws us to that, that doesn't happen when we're talking about, marginal incremental improvements in, polio eradication or something.
Yeah. And I think that, I don't know what that is about the human condition where you know, and Devin, I don't know what would happen if all of a sudden the nightly news spent as much time reporting good stuff as they did reporting, quote, negative stuff. I'll use the word negative stuff, right? I don't know. I don't know if people would turn off the news. Would they tune in more? Would they, you know, I would like to think that they would get a bump in ratings. You know, one of the reasons that people are drawn to things like America's Got Talent or these types of shows is because we like to see these underdogs win. We like to see people who, you know, who surprise us because they look, I guess, so ordinary, and they go in there and they just, you know, blow our minds.
Yeah. It's, you know, the producers have figured that out, and so they love to cast people, in fact, as underdogs, as unlikely heroes, even when they know they're really fabulous, and then they play that up, and of course play to that part of our psyche, right? That wants to see the unlikely hero. So yes, there is that, certainly that aspect of we love an underdog.
So let me ask you this. I want to jump into this idea and get you to talk about social entrepreneurship and how do you define that?
So when I think about social entrepreneurs, I'm thinking about people who start a business, for profit or nonprofit, with the primary intention of solving or addressing a social issue rather than to make money or make a living. And because that's how I think about that. And they come in all varieties. Those entrepreneurs who become passionate after the fact and incorporate a social mission, in my mind, are not technically social entrepreneurs. They're doing a form of corporate social responsibility, which is deeply admirable. I'm glad they're doing it. But in my mind, the intention at the outset is a key element of becoming a real social entrepreneur. And it's, you know, of course, these are wonderful, inspiring people, and I write about a lot of them, and it's fun to see their progress.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know what? I think that at least most of the entrepreneurs that I've met, in the back of their mind, one of the things that drives them is this idea to give back to the community. Some people have that in the front of their mind saying, hey, you know, I want to be able to support my favorite charities. And if I'm, you know, once my business, whereas my business becomes more and more successful, I can do more good. And I think that's part of having, a well-rounded life, for lack of better terms. I mean, it's great to make a lot of money, but sooner or later, there's only so many things that you can buy unless you're a really greedy, selfish individual. I think sooner or later, you got to start thinking about other people.
Yeah. And I think that's a really excellent point. You know, I kind of had that mindset in my life that I would make money first and that then I would transition to doing good. And I've made that transition. But what's interesting is there's sort of a new model that's developed and more people in their careers want to do good as an inherent fundamental part of their career and not just wait until they have made money to do good. And I find that really an admirable career approach, and especially with entrepreneurs who set out to really fundamentally address a social problem and bake that into the actual business model and not just tack it on to the side of a business. And let me give you an example of the distinction. There's a company here in Salt Lake called Even Stevens. And they developed a business model where they would donate sandwiches to nonprofits. for every time you bought a sandwich. And it was a very effective business strategy. But the company got overextended. They grew too fast, and they had to suspend all of the donations to nonprofits in order to try to save the business. Ultimately, they filed for bankruptcy. That was really sad to see. But, you know, we see all the time entrepreneurs who are also creating businesses that fundamentally in the very nature of their operations are addressing a social problem. Like this morning, I shared a podcast that I produced with a fellow who is building using artificial intelligence to scour the interwebs to learn everything it can about grants, government grants. So every level of government all around the country. And then this tool will be useful for nonprofits and other, you know, socially minded people who might be eligible for those grants, because in theory, the tool will make it easier not only for them to find, but also to apply for grants. And then there will be reciprocal tools where the government agencies will have an easier time finding good people to make grants to, and may even have an easier time in gathering their accountability. And so you can see that enterprise is, you know, very high tech, very exciting, but fundamentally in its core, central to its being, is a social mission of matching government grants to worthy nonprofit actors. And so the more successful that enterprise is, the more money is matched to nonprofits, the better the world is. So it's a very different model than, you know, selling a sandwich and giving a sandwich away. So anyway, that's an important contrast, I think, as we talk about social entrepreneurship. All is good. You know, I love what Even Stevens tried to do and for so many years did. I'm hoping they'll be able to emerge from bankruptcy and carry on. But this other company I was talking about is called Egeria, and it's exciting to see that, and I hope they're successful.
Sure. Yeah, you know, bottom line is, you know, one aspect of entrepreneurship is that we're here as entrepreneurs to solve problems. And sometimes those problems are I don't know, let's say ordinary problems, like a fast food restaurant solves a problem. And in some cases, we're here to solve more complex problems. Let's say something that's medical or life-threatening. But ultimately, as an entrepreneur, we serve people. And I think that you look at somebody like a Bill Gates, you know, and some of the people that he is, has been able to inspire and encourage to give a substantial amount of their earnings or wealth to his organization, so therefore he can, you know, he can have this. So it's not so much about him and Melinda, but so that these wealthy individuals can take and make a real difference. I mean, you know, they're helping with medical situations in these third world countries. They're helping build schools. They're helping with creating clean water or helping deliver clean water. And, you know, I think that at the end of your life on Earth, it's great that you made a successful business, but ultimately the question is, who did you impact? And I think that, you know, that's ultimately what we all want to be able to say as entrepreneurs. Hey, I had an impact. I made a difference. And not even as entrepreneurs, just as human beings. I think that we all want to be able to say that I came to Earth and I made a difference and I helped a few, or I helped hundreds or help thousands and or whatever. Let me ask you this. How can, let's say, ordinary investors buy shares in social enterprises? Give me your thoughts on this.
Now, this is really, this is a fun aspect of, you know, the space in which I work, because the world has changed pretty radically. If you go back 5 years, it was essentially illegal for ordinary investors to buy shares in a startup. There were some narrow exceptions, but as a result, none of us ever did that. In 2012, Congress, in a bipartisan bill, passed a law called the Jobs Act. President Obama signed that, and but it took 4 years for Congress to implement all of its aspects. And so it wasn't until 2016 that the regulations were implemented, allowing people to, ordinary investors, you know, regular people that aren't rich, to buy shares in startups. And now they can. And so there a lot of these little platforms have popped up. WeFunder, Crowdfund Main Street, Crowdfunder. There are a whole bunch of them. There are about 40 of them, where you can go online now and you can screen businesses, startups, and invest in them. And of course, many are not social enterprises. But what excites me is it looks to me like about a third of the companies issuing shares on these platforms are in fact social enterprises, have a social mission. And, you know, sometimes it's not like super high impact, but I think it's still important, like electric bicycles. That's a whole genre of entrepreneurship these days. And that's an exciting thing. I think electric bicycles are a key part of addressing climate change, because they allow us to make short trips with small amounts of energy instead of using a car. And so they're really, I think, a key part of the solution. Anyway, there are all kinds of things that people can buy. So you go on these websites and you very much get to do everything that a venture capitalist has traditionally done in making an investment. So you can interact with the management team to learn more about their enterprises. The offering documents are all there online. You can read them. You can read other people's questions and the answers that the management teams have given to the other questions, and to learn about what's going on at the enterprise and whether to make an investment. And then the cool thing is, each issuer gets to decide what the minimum investment is, but $50 or $100 is pretty common, and it's rare for it to be over $1,000. So most of us can afford to make a small investment in one of these companies and build a small portfolio of investments in startups, just like a venture capitalist would. So it's a very exciting time to be an ordinary investor. I think about it, like, how would it be to invest in, you know, Microsoft in its earliest days, before the venture capitalists got in, right? You know, that's what we're kind of talking about here.
Yeah, that is exciting, especially if you are, as you said at the top of the show, if you're focused on social good. This is a great thing that to be able to get involved with, you know, several companies and donate, as you said, $50 or $100 or whatever you feel comfortable donating, or not donating so much as investing. And maybe not only do you get a return on your investment, but you get to see the impact that this company is doing and know that you had a hand in that.
Yeah. Absolutely. It is exciting. It's fun. And, it's a great complement to the philanthropy that I think almost all Americans do. Americans are really generous people, and I'm proud of that feature of Americans. We can do better about the way we are, how thoughtful we are about our investments and their social and environmental impact. And so this is one way to do that, right? To invest some money. And I certainly wouldn't encourage anyone to invest too much in startups. It's a risky asset class.
Sure.
But one win in that space could make up for a lot of losses. That's what venture capitalists learn.
Absolutely. I'm glad you said it like that, because that's why venture capitalists, real venture capitalists, the reason that they do what they do is because they know they're going to lose 80% of the time, and they're going to make their money on the 20%. And so these guys, they know that going in. And so I think that if you are investing in social enterprises, you have to have the same thought that, hey, most likely this company is going to go under, but what if it doesn't? I mean, to me, that would be a great story to be able to invest in the next Microsoft or the next Google in those early stages and have that investment be worth an incredible amount of money, 5-10 years down the road.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to get your thoughts on this, because, and again, we see this in the media sometimes, and I think that sometimes corporations and entrepreneurs are sometimes stigmatized or are kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, are looked at as the problem in our world today. And so I want to get your thoughts on this, because, again, some people think that corporations are at fault or that corporations are part of the problem. And just give me your thoughts on this.
Yeah, it is interesting. A lot of my lefty friends especially tend to think of corporations as creating a lot of social problems. They don't pay people a living wage, and they hurt the environment. They exploit indigenous people in the developing world. And quite frankly, many of those observations are true, but I like to point out that what most people want more than anything in this world, or one of the things they want most, is a job. And the best place to get a job is in a company, a corporation, right? And
right.
So many of us aspire to that job for a variety of good reasons. And I'll give you just an example of the tension in this space and why I think sometimes we're too hard on companies. But imagine a low-wage factory in Bangladesh where people are making $2 or $3 an hour in sweatshop conditions. Our reaction to that is likely to be to think, we should shut that place down. That's horrible.
Right.
What you have to understand is that in Bangladesh, that's the good job, right? That's the job people queue up for days to get. People desperately want those jobs because they are among the only jobs. It's so hard to make that much money any other way. 50% of the people in Bangladesh are living not on $2 an hour or $3 an hour, but $2 or $3 a day.
A day, yeah.
So you get a $2 or $3 an hour job, and suddenly your life is transformed, right? Now you have enough food to eat every single day. You can send your kids to school so that they have a shot at actually going to college. I mean, your life is completely different because you got that job. Now, does that mean that we should completely leave that company off the hook, that we shouldn't insist that they create a safe working environment? Very famously, about 5 years ago, there was a plant that, just like what I'm describing in Bangladesh, that collapsed and killed hundreds of people. I certainly don't advocate that, right? That was a horrific tragedy. So there is a tension there between these two sides of that coin. And I think it's good to have the discussions. I think it's always good to put pressure on companies to be better, to do more. There's never an end to being able to do better, to do more good. At the same time, I think we need to recognize that if it weren't for companies providing jobs, the world would be a much, much, much worse place. So, you know, we have to look at both sides of those issues.
Yeah. Well, you know what? And people forget about our industrial history, right? I mean, people forget that here in America, we did the exact same thing. At one point here in America, they would chain you to your workstation as a child.
Yeah.
And we didn't have, you know, safety was a secondary thought. I mean, we forget where we came from sometimes. And so it's easy for us to judge these third world countries because we're 100 years ahead of them. But at one point,
yeah,
America was a third world country. America was doing stuff that was savage. I mean, who would ever think to take a child and literally chain them to their workstation? Who does that?
Yeah.
It's just crazy. But that's what we did. And luckily we grew from that. And we learned from our mistakes. And just like the example that you gave, we have our own examples of terrible, unfortunate mishaps where people died. And because we learned from those mistakes, conditions got better. But, you know, when, you know, a company is struggling and trying to get off, you know, trying to take that first step, it's an effort it's just, you know, it's one of those things that everybody has to buy into a little bit. So, hey, today I can only pay you, you know, a buck or two a day, and this is the current condition that we're in, but hopefully in the next 2 years things will get better. And so that's what, you know, that's part of the buy-in. Let me ask you this. I want to talk about three ways that our listeners can have an impact with their money, and talk about these three ways.
Sure. Well, the first way is to donate, and to donate thoughtfully. There's some great ways to give more effectively. Great websites. There's a website called GiveWell that my son is a particular fan of. GuideStar is another. But, you know, do just a little bit of research on a nonprofit, and you'll be able to figure out very quickly if they are well-regarded and if it's a good place to give. And that's true of most nonprofits. That is, that the information is available. The tiniest, newest ones are not. And you'll need to decide whether how you would evaluate giving to a tiny nonprofit. And I wouldn't say that that's inherently bad, by the way. Oftentimes, tiny nonprofits are led by volunteers. And that means that the dollars are all going into program and are very effectively used. So it isn't necessarily a bad thing to be tiny and new, but I would encourage people to give. That's thing one. Thing two, we talked about already, but that is to invest for impact. And this is an exciting time to do that. In addition to investing via the crowdfunding sites I was talking about earlier, there are a few other ways to invest, and just depositing your money with a bank or credit union that has a good policy. And there are a few of these around, like Southern Bank Corp is a bank that is really committed to serving low-income communities in Arkansas and Mississippi. I was out there, working on a story for Forbes a couple of weeks ago. Most credit unions have really good policies to serve their communities, and so they're not taking advantage of people. They're not investing in private prisons or fossil fuels, generally speaking. So that's a great thing. And then so invest for good is certainly a second one. And then the third is to shop wisely. Think about spending your dollars more in local businesses and in businesses that have a good social impact track record, that are good corporate citizens. And it doesn't have to be small businesses. I do own a few shares of Microsoft. I should probably disclose this as I say this, but Microsoft has a really good corporate social responsibility effort going on. They're giving away about 1% of their revenue and value to people. About 10% of that giveaway is cash. So they're giving away $100 million of cash to nonprofits every year. And they give away about $1 billion worth of product to nonprofits every year. More and more nonprofits I come across are getting really valuable Microsoft software and services for free. And it's making a huge difference in the world. And so that's a great thing that, we can be mindful of is are the companies we are doing business with, are they doing their fair share? And it's not too hard to find out. So that's the third way to use your money in a way that will drive impact.
Yeah, I like that. Because I think that more and more corporations do have some kind of community giving opportunity right on their website. And so, as you said, you can easily find out. I mean, I think, is it Tom Shoes that kind of really did the whole thing like even Steven did, right? You buy a pair, we give away a pair. And they certainly were not hurt by that strategy. And I have four women in my life, my wife, and I have three daughters, and all of them have at least a couple of pairs of Tom shoes. I think my oldest daughter has, four or five pairs. It's, it's crazy.
Yeah, that's great. It's interesting. Tom's has gone away from the one for one giving away shoes that made them so famous.
I know.
Now, instead of giving the money away for in the form of shoes to people who can't afford their own shoes, they picked up gun safety as their issue, and they use the money. They give the money to nonprofits that are trying to make the world a safer place in terms of guns. So that's an interesting shift in their work recently.
Yeah. It's, and when they did that change, again, you can see why they made that change. We've had multiple issues with gun shootings at school and all this other stuff.
And
I could see them saying, hey, maybe we can have a bigger impact this way.
I think they were also criticized for the economic impact of giving shoes away in the developing world, because it sometimes made it difficult for the people who made and sold shoes there. It made it more difficult when someone was giving away shoes in the community.
Sure.
So I think that I'm not sure that criticism was always fair. If you're giving shoes to someone who absolutely can't afford to buy shoes, you have not impacted the economy at all. And you may teach someone to value shoes even more so that they will buy shoes in the future. So I'm not sure it was fair criticism, but I know they were criticized for that And so that probably was the other part of that equation. And they had done a variety of things to try to address that by, you know, for instance, buying shoes in, from the developing world for the developing world so that they weren't having a net negative impact on the shoe supply that they're anyway. Interesting things, but your point is well made fundamentally that that people are often drawn to social impact companies when they make their purchases, and I think it's a great thing for us to consciously seek to do.
Absolutely. And you know what, and I do kind of want to hover on this criticism thing. Unfortunately, we will always be criticized no matter what we do. And the reality is you are better off doing what you believe is right and being criticized than not doing anything at all. And yep. No matter what, whatever it is you do, you give $1 million to, you know, to a charity, somebody will criticize you. You know, no matter what, you're going to be criticized because you could have, would have, should have. And what's always interesting to me, Devin, is that the people who are criticizing are people who are not doing anything, who are probably not giving, you know, their fair share. You know, my favorite, you know, my favorite, what do you call it, critics. And I believe this is critics across the table. But if you look at a movie critic, they get paid, to me, an obscene amount of money to criticize professionals, to criticize content, to criticize artwork that they themselves cannot do or are not doing for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I've never heard an actor or a director criticize, you know, somebody the way a critic does, you know. And so that, I think, is the way critics work. There's a lot of critics out there that make a lot of money criticizing other people's efforts, but yet, you know, they don't do anything. I mean, I don't know a restaurant critic that is famous for his food. And therefore, he can come in and say, hey, you know, I've done all this food stuff. I've done, you know, here's the, what do you call it, a resume of my work. I've done, you know, I'm famous for this dish. I've run multiple restaurants, and I retired, and I became a food critic. Okay, I'll have a little bit more respect for you. But when your job is just to be a critic and you haven't ever done anything, how do you get that job? I mean, it's just like...
I wrote an article for Forbes about just that thing. I called the article "You're Doing Good Wrong," and it was interesting. One of the things that I mentioned in this article is that people are sometimes critical of Bill Gates for having kind of an ivory tower approach to doing good, you know, sitting in Seattle and making decisions without input from people on the ground. And I pointed out that one of the things that he's done is to partner with Rotary International, which has clubs in about 200 countries around the world. So wherever he goes in his work with fighting polio, for instance, with Rotary, he has eyes and ears on the ground, people who are living in those communities and can help not only deliver the vaccines, but provide feedback on the processes. So he's got this great two-way street. And so that's what I pointed out in the article. The outcome of that was the Gates Foundation reached out to me and asked me if I would like to interview Bill. So I'm going to interview Bill Gates next week. I'm very excited about that.
Oh, that is way cool. I mean, first of all, that's way cool for a couple of different reasons. Obviously, you know, when they're reaching out to you, that's they're aware of your work. That's nice. Congratulations for that alone. Second of all, when they say, "Would you like to interview this person or that person?" That's even better. That's Very nice. Congratulations on both of those.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I am very excited.
Yeah.
As you can imagine.
Yeah, I can certainly imagine that. That's awesome. That is awesome. Let's see. I'm trying to think. So let me ask you this: how did you get started down this road? I mean, kind of give us a scenario, what you were doing, and how you ended up here.
Yeah. So I was. Go back. As you know, I won't spend the whole time telling you, but when I was 11, I was my dad dragged me up to Rexburg, Idaho, to dig muck and mud out of basements after the Teton Dam failed and nearly wiped out the town of Rexburg. And you know, I was a little kid, and I really probably didn't do any good that day, but I really felt like I'd made a difference in the world, and I just vowed to myself that I would never miss an opportunity to do good, to serve other people. But over the years, of course, I did miss lots of opportunities. But when I was about, golly, what was I? I was about 46. I got fired from the best job I'd ever had and had a little severance package. That was great. And so I kind of said, this is my opportunity. I kind of channeled that enthusiasm of my youth and began a transition. I went to China for a year. I wrote a book called Your Mark on the World, which is a book about using your money for good. And came home from that China experience, committed to making that a career. I wasn't sure what shape or form that would take. Serendipitously, I was invited to write a guest post for Forbes, and they invited me to be a regular contributor. I've been doing that now for 7 years, written over 500 articles for Forbes, and it's been a great, great experience. So that's kind of how I made that transition from chief financial officer, investment banker, corporate treasurer, you know, to champion of social good.
Yeah, no, it's a great, it's great. The best job you ever had, just out of curiosity, what was that job?
So I was the chief financial officer for a company called Monavie that manufactured and sold food and beverages.
Gotcha.
Around the world. So it was a great company. About 5 years after I left, they were essentially acquired by a much larger business. After they'd struggled for a few years, they shouldn't have fired me. I'm glad they did in so many ways.
Absolutely. Just out of curiosity, because I'm sure that you get this question quite a bit. How can people have an impact without using money?
Yeah, there are lots and lots of ways. 5 years ago, you may recall, there was the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. Do you remember that,
yes.
Bert?
Yes.
Yeah. So one of the things that came out of that is I was amazed at how resentful some people were. And it was a pretty common feeling that people who simply dumped ice water on their heads were doing no good, that it was silly. The ALS folks that summer raised over $100 million. The people who dumped ice over their heads but did not donate did an incredible amount of good. It was the most successful crowdfunding campaign for nonprofits ever in history, bar none and by far. Just really an inspiring thing. And it proved, better than any other thing I've ever seen, the power of helping to spread a message. So it is meaningful when people who don't have the money to give share a story on social media about a cause, because some of their friends do have means and ability to give. It is easy and meaningful to adopt a pet that has been a shelter, you know, a shelter animal. It's meaningful and incredibly valuable to nonprofit organizations to go volunteer. So there are all kinds of ways to make a huge difference in the world without spending any money. And I encourage people to do it. I do have a strategy that I really is the theme of my book, Your Mark on the World, that I wrote back in China back in, you know, 2012. But, you know, the idea is that if you align your giving with your volunteering, it becomes extra powerful. It really does. Because what will happen over time, let's just say, Bert, that you have someone that is making, let's just say $75,000 a year. There are probably a lot of your listeners who make more than that, but let's just say $75,000 a year. And let's say you're willing to give 5% of that away every year. That's nearly $4,000. If you were to give all of that $4,000 to one cause and volunteer your time, you would become one of the most significant donors in the local community for that cause. And pretty soon you're going to find yourself on committees and planning and organizing thing, and then you'll be on the board. And now your money is not only going to help do good, but your time and wisdom now is being leveraged. And you are really making a big difference. And if you did that over your entire career, let's say you're 30 and you're making $75,000 a year and you start doing this 5% to one cause thing for the rest of your career, well, over the span of your career of the next 30, 35 years, you would give hundreds of thousands of dollars to that organization. And your leadership would become extraordinary. You know, they'll build a statue to you at the end of your career, and yet you may never become rich by ordinary conception of it, but your total giving would have been extraordinary. So, yeah, I encourage people to combine their service with their philanthropy to really have the most impact.
I love that. I love that. Great idea. Great example, that ALS challenge, the ice bucket challenge, goes to show you that if you're creative, you can have a massive impact.
Absolutely.
It isn't about just money. There's a lot of stuff that you can do about, you know, and it's just a matter of being creative. Devin, we're out of time. I want to say thank you so much for stopping by, and cannot wait to read your interview or hear or listen to your interview with Bill Gates. Is that going to be audio or written? How is that going to be done?
It's going to be audio, video, and then I'll do a write-up for Forbes about it. So, you can watch my Forbes channel for that. Just search Devin Thorpe on Forbes, and that'll be out before the end of May.
Awesome. And then for anybody else who wants to catch your show, the show is called Your Mark on the World. And you can just Google Your Mark on the World or Google Devin Thorpe. Just out of curiosity, does your show, Your Mark on the World, does it have a website?
Sort of. It has two websites, well, three. So I post some episodes on Forbes, some episodes on yourmarkontheworld.com, and some episodes on goodcrowd.info when we're talking about crowdfunding.
I love it. All right. So, Mark, what is it? YourMarkOnTheWorld.com. Forbes.
And GoodCrowd.info and Forbes.
All right. I love it. Devin Thorpe, thank you so much for stopping by today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Bert. Really appreciate you having me.
You bet. Good stuff there from Devin Thorpe. Just love his focus. I love this idea of being a social entrepreneur. let's do this. Let's share this episode with everyone we know. Let's help everybody start thinking about being a social entrepreneur, helping them maybe to raise their standards a little bit. Maybe you're already involved with the charity and you might get some ideas from this episode. As always, my friends, thank you so much for listening. And remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.